أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الهمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن الذي ليس لصفته حد محدود ولا نعت موجود ولا وقت معدود ولا أجل محدود أما بعد فقد قال الله الحكيم في محكم كتابه الكريم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا قيل لكم تفسحوا في المجالس فافسحوا يفسح الله لكم وإذا قيل انشزوا فانشزوا يرفع الله الذين آمنوا منكم وأوتوا الذين أوتوا العلم درجات والله بما تعملون خبير صدق الله العلي العظيم صلوات اللهم صل على محمد. For the love of our beloved Prophet and his beloved progeny, a second loud salawat. Allahumma salam. For the hastening in the return of our beloved 12th Imam, a third final loud salawat. Allahumma salam. The topic we'll be discussing tonight, inshallah, is titled The Case for Islamic Schools. There's a reason why on a special night like this that is dedicated to our beloved Mawla Abbas, we have chosen a topic like this, because this topic directly correlates with the character of this special figure in the plains of Karbala. When you look at someone like Abbas alayhi salam, it is not a coincidence that you find him in the plains of Karbala being the backbone to the caravan of Abu Abdullah. He is an individual who is brought up and raised with the values of the Ahlul Bayt. He is the one who has witnessed the battlefield and the fighting of Amirul Mu'mineen. He is the one who's seen how his father walks and talks and carries himself. He is the one who has seen the ghurba and the loneliness of our second imam. And he is the one who's seen the braveness and the bravery of our beloved third imam. Abbas is a student of the school of the Ahlul Bayt. And this is an issue that today our communities also deal with. Any community across the world that you visit, whether it is a Shia community or a Sunni community, and even when it comes to other faiths as well, you will find one of their biggest concerns is how do I make sure that the next generation will follow in these footsteps. You will find masajid and centers, they will spend thousands of dollars or thousands of pounds, whatever the case might be, to purchase a very nice facility for themselves. They will put the most beautiful carpet within this facility. And this is not to say this is not important. This is part of building a community. But what truly shows the success of a community is not whether the carpet is set and community members will come and pray on this carpet. What shows the success of a community is whether the children of that generation will also come and pray within this carpet as well. Many masajid that you go, you will find one generation is deeply connected to their Islamic faith and values, whereas the children of that same generation are nowhere to be found. And hence you find, regardless of where you travel, this is a concern within our communities. As big as the concern is, you don't find the mobilization that is needed to tackle this issue within our communities. You will find our communities are extremely slow and inefficient in responding to the needs of the time. Some communities you go to, and I've been to, still they're debating, do we have a need for an English speaker, or can we stick to the language of the generation who initially immigrated to this country or other countries? Then it might take them another decade to move from having an English lecture to having a speaker come forward who can actually discuss relevant topics. God knows in the decades that pass by how many of our youth and our children we have lost by the time a community comes together and says these are serious needs within our community. Hence you find, as severe as this need is, the mobilization is extremely slow. There are efforts that are made, and those efforts are definitely appreciated. In our communities, when you talk about the younger generation, they will point to a madrasa. They will say we have a strong madrasa. They will say we have youth events that happen. They will say we have English lectures and speakers who come forward and deliver these lectures. None of these, however, are going to have the type of impact that an Islamic school can have on these children and on a community. But the moment you mention the word Islamic school or these couple of words, there are a number of reservations, objections that come up in this regard. Should I put my child into an environment that is different from the norms within society? Will he be raised in a bubble and isolated from society? When he leaves the school, will he be able to hold a conversation with those who don't necessarily agree with his faith? Fundamentally, what if this school is not academically at the level that it needs to be? And many other issues that come up here. And many of these issues that we will discuss tonight actually go back to the very roots of bringing up children and raising children, that which the Ahlul Bayt taught us to do in the best of ways. Therefore, tonight, we want to take some time to delve into this topic. And in order to do so, we'll pose the following questions. Number one, is the LGBTQ agenda and sexual education within our schools the number one issue when it comes to schooling within this community or other communities and within the societies that we live in? Or are there a number and a whole list of issues when it comes to schooling that you find outside? Number two, does a strong madrasa, a strong community, strong youth events, wonderful English speakers, whatever the case might be, make up for the impact that the wrong schooling can potentially have on the future and upbringing of my child? Number three, what did the Quran teach us about having a thirst for knowledge and the growth that you will experience when you gain more knowledge? And does the schooling in the societies that we live in instill this value in our children or not? Number four, what makes a school Islamic anyways? Is it just that everyone enters into the school has to wear a hijab, for example? Is that there's only halal meat in this school? Or are there a number of elements that build an Islamic atmosphere for our schools? Number five, what are the five main objections that people make when it comes to enrolling their children in Islamic schools? Number six, is this element or the lack thereof, the lack of proper schooling, wherever I'm living, whichever community it is this heavy enough of an element to push me to potentially look at other communities and consider moving from one community to another community? And number seven, and finally, how did our beloved Mawla Abbas show that he was raised in the school and with the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt? Tonight, inshallah, we'll delve into these seven questions with a loud salawat ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad. Today, brothers and sisters, you will find parents all around the world have become extremely concerned about their upbringing of their children, and in particular, the schooling of their children. You will find parents who come forward who they themselves sometimes don't even practice the faith. They will come forward and say, "Sheikh, I'm very worried about my children. Now, normally when this is brought up to me, I look them back and I say, if you're so worried about your children, why is it you're not practicing the faith yourself? Because the only thing that that parent is worried about is if his child comes home with the wrong pronouns one day. The only thing that that parent is worried about is if the child comes home and says, you know what, Baba, there can be two fathers in a family, there can be two mothers in a family. That's the only concern that he has. And hence you find within our communities, we have begun to see the LGBTQ agenda as the number one issue and the only issue that we have to be worried about. We don't find the other fundamental flaws we have within our communities. This has become the standard. As long as this doesn't happen in my household, there's no other problems. I can put my child in any environment as long as they don't teach him this kind of stuff. The reality is, when it comes to schools and the environment where I am raising my children, there are a lot more problems than just this. Far before this issue became one of the prevalent issues, schooling was giving our children the wrong values. This is the root of a lot of the issues we have in our communities. We can't be blind when it comes to this issue. Turn a blind eye to it. And then when my child is 18 and he doesn't want to pray anymore, I sit there and call the sheikh. Sheikh, come have a conversation with him. What were you doing for 18 years? How are you preparing for this moment? Every single person sitting here, I'm giving you this bad news ahead of time. Yes, forgive me, I'm the bad one tonight. Yes, I'm giving you this bad news ahead of time. When the child reaches that age, he's going to begin to revolt. If you haven't worked with him in the past 18 years, 20 years, whatever the case might be, there's no more stopping him at that point. He will make his own decisions because he's almost an adult at that point. Almost is building his own life at this point. This is coming. The LGBTQ issue is not the only issue you should be worried about. And if that's the only issue you're worried about, then you're looking at things in a very wrong way. You say, well, what other problems are there in schooling or in society in general? Number one, within schooling that you find out there, there is a major lack of respect for elders and tradition. This is embedded within the schooling system and within society as a whole. This isn't worrisome to you? This isn't something you should be concerned about. This is very problematic. Number two, there is an overemphasis on looks over character. Anyone who goes to school nowadays knows this. The moment something goes viral, that is what builds the world that day. Is it positive, negative? Doesn't matter. What's important are the looks. Number three of those elements that you find is what? Is explicit content. And I can't go into detail on this. But this is a major problem, especially for our young brothers. This is number three. Number four, exposure to drugs, alcohol, so on and so forth. Number five, a severe emphasis on social media and screens. This is the world that we live in. Now, many of the parents are sitting there, and I will get to a lot of the objections. They'll say, Sheikh, it's okay, I went through this schooling system too. Look, Sheikh, I turned out fine. First of all, that objection we will get to, but let me just tell you, what you went through is nothing like what your children are going through. Nothing. Don't even make the comparison. Social media was not even a thing when you were a child. Hence, you have zero understanding of what this world looks like today. The best you had was that dial-up internet. You know, the one that made the weird sound when it was connecting. And everybody else in the house had to stop using their phones. Yes? I know these younger kids are looking at me weird. Yes? That's the best you had. That was your world. Even if you grew up in this part of the world, your schooling experience is different. Let alone if you immigrated. These are the values that our child is constantly being exposed to, other than the LGBTQ issue. Set that aside. We have to take a deeper approach when it comes to this topic. Hence, you find within our communities, there are efforts to solve this issue. There are many who come forward and say, Sheikh, yes. That's why we complement our schooling with a very strong madrasa, with a weekend Islamic school. There are others come forward, they say, we complement our public schooling with a lot of youth events. We complement our schooling and what's happening in society with strong English speakers. None of these are going to make up for the impact that your child is taking in 8 hours every single day. The air that he is breathing in has the wrong values. And he is absorbing that like a sponge. 8 hours a day. Now you're telling me this madrasa, he's going to come. One day the teacher shows up. The other day the teacher doesn't show up. One day half of the students know the lesson. The other half don't know the lesson. This student is 20 lessons behind. This one is 20 lessons ahead. What are we talking about? None of these are going to be able to make up for the impact that you find on our children. I need an environment where my child can breathe within Islamic values. Now, whenever this discussion comes up, there are two sides to this discussion. There are those parents who only look at the threats and trying to avoid the threats of negative values. They don't even look at the plus side. So what does that mean? He says, listen, my standard for my child is I just want him to go through school and society and all this kind of stuff. And then he's going to get married later. From this point until that point, I just want to make sure, Sheikh, he doesn't do drugs. He doesn't have a girlfriend and, you know, this type of stuff. And then he'll be fine. Why is that your standard for your child? Why is that what you're setting as the golden standard? He can absorb all of the un-Islamic values, but I just, you know, these couple things and he'll be fine. No, why? Why should I want to raise a child that's only tolerating his religion? Why shouldn't I raise a child who's completely connected to his religion? Why shouldn't I raise a child who's in love with his religion? Why shouldn't I raise a child who looks forward to participating in the programs? Why shouldn't that be my standard? Say, Sheikh, this one went through the schooling. He didn't end up in these problems. Yes, I ask you, did he grow up and feel in love with the religion? Or does he tolerate religion? Or is religion a little thing on the side in his life? The majority of the times you will find it's the latter. And I will come closer to this objection. Okay, so you say, okay, Sheikh, well, what's the solution? The solution is Islamic schools. Okay, what is Islamic school anyways? I know some Islamic schools, they don't do so well anyways. They're not even that Islamic. I agree with you. There are schools, they say they're Islamic schools, they're not even that Islamic. But let us break down what an Islamic school is even built of. Number one, the basic rules and regulations in the school, the skeleton of the rules and regulations have to be Islamic. Yes, this we understand. Now, if there are schools, they have some of these elements, they don't have all of them, doesn't mean they don't have any value. You understand this point, yes? They still offer a lot of value. The more, the better of these principles. The skeleton of the school has to be an Islamic school. There has to be an understanding that here you bring halal food. At least this is the understanding. These are the basic ones. I call this the skeleton because it's very easy to do this and implement this. That's element number one. Element number two, the atmosphere of schooling that my child is going through has to project Islamic values. When men and women come in this school, do they speak to each other as if they're Muslims? Or do they speak to each other as if they're working in some corporation? You know, in some corporations, men and women, they speak to each other, they giggle with each other. Afterwards, na'udhu billah, they go out for a drink together. It's normal. There's no idea of boundaries between us. These are Islamic values. Does the school encourage respect? Does the school encourage character over your looks and how you dress and what brands you're wearing in today's world and in today's society? These are Islamic values. This is number two. Number three, does the school have a strong Islamic curriculum? Your learning and the learning of Islam for our families, brothers and sisters, if it's confined to these 10 nights of Muharram, we are in trouble. This is a major problem that we have. What type of knowledge is the school offering to my children? Element number three. Let us move on to element number four. Does the school connect my child with Islamic mentors, Islamic scholars? Do you know what it means for a 12-year-old to be in school? And then the sheikh comes in the school, sits with them a little bit. They talk, they ask questions. I know what it's like because I had that experience. For the rest of his life, he looks up to this person. For the rest of his life, he says, yeah, you remember that sheikh came? We could relate to him, yes? And part of the responsibility of the school is to make this connection. Why? Because your child will have questions that no one can answer unless that person is a well-qualified scholar. Doesn't matter what curriculum your madrasa has. Doesn't matter. There's going to be questions. No one will be able to answer them unless it's a well-qualified scholar. Do you connect your children with these scholars? I'll share a very quick note, yes? I remember I was 10 or 12 maybe, having a conversation with my father. My father told me, you know, there's hadith that every single animal in the world is, you know, doing tasbih. Except the birds, they never fall prey unless when they stop doing tasbih. The bird is only hunted when he has stopped doing tasbih. That's when he is hunted. Now, in my own little childish world, I said, but Baba, that doesn't make sense. He said, how? He said, it doesn't make sense because the Quran says, سَبَّحَ لِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ. Yes, when we read this in Surah Al-Jum'ah, يُسَبِّحُ لِلَّهِ, sometimes سَبَّحَ, whatever. Everything in the heavens and the earth is doing tasbih of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I said, this doesn't make sense with the verses of the Quran. He said, huh. There was this very heavy silence. He said, huh. When you meet Ayatollah Fulan, you should ask him this question. Why? Because he didn't have the answer to the question. But he had the humility to understand, I have to connect my child with those who can answer these questions. This is part of Islamic schooling. Number five, yes, the school has to provide for my child competitive academics. Keyword competitive, not top. I will come to that objection right now. When you talk about Islamic schooling, brothers and sisters, you will find five main objections people will make. And this is from hundreds of conversations with parents in different communities, different countries of the world, yes? Number one, say, Sheikh, I don't know if I need to put my child into an Islamic school. Why? What's the problem? Because the level of academics in this Islamic school is not that high. There's other schools that can give him a better opportunity when it comes to his career. I agree and disagree with this point. Yes, an Islamic school has to give your child a fighting chance. It's a real world out there. But brothers and sisters, we have to now move on from the mentality that some of our parents had, that it's all about that degree. It's all about that title. It's all about what school you went to, because even today, the job market is not like this anymore. Now, it's about your soft skills. Now, it's about how you can work in a team. Now, it's about how comfortable you are within your own skin. Now, it's about the confidence that you carry. Now, it's about your work ethic. Now, it's about your passion in this field. Go look at universities. How do they choose students? Do they say, oh, which one of you guys has the highest grades? Is this what they say? No. What do they say? They say, which one of you guys is the most passionate? Which one of you guys is not going to stop at any point and continue learning about this? And let's just say the school that your child goes to, if it's an online option, in-person option, whatever the case might be, yes, the academics are a little less. Don't worry, if he has the right character and the right values, he will outwork everybody else. He will be more successful than everybody else. The thirst for knowledge, brothers and sisters, is something that Islam teaches. And trust me, just putting my child into a good school doesn't necessarily instill in him the love for knowledge. What does the Quran say? The Quran says, يَرْفَعِ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مِنْكُمْ. Allah will raise those of you, وَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ دَرَجَاتٍ. The knowledge that you gain, you spiritually grow from it. A thirst for knowledge. Hence you find these narrations. They said, Al-hikmatu dhallatu al-mu'min. Hikmah is that thing that the believer is constantly looking for. Knowledge, wisdom is that thing that the believer is constantly looking for. instill these values in him, he will outwork everybody else. This is objection number one. If my child is not at the top school, and maybe he has to work a little bit harder on his academics, but he has the right values, he has the right characteristics, he knows what his life is all about, he has the right values, he is grounded. You don't think he can be successful in society? Oh, trust me, he'll be successful, more successful than a lot of other people. This is objection number one. Allah salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Objection number two. Well, I don't want to put my child into an Islamic school. You know why, Sheikh? Because I don't want to raise my child in a bubble. I wish at this point you could raise your child in a bubble. Let me say something for the dear parents. If your child at any point in his life is going to end up with an iPad or an iPhone or whatever the case might be, yes? If you buy them some Samsung, I'm not friends with you. That's a separate thing, yes? But if you give them a phone or an iPad, a tablet, whatever, the whole world is at the fingertips of your child. You don't have to worry about your child figuring things out. So many parents, so naive sometimes, say, I'm worried my child won't know how to carry himself in society. Trust me, your child will know very well. Yes, there are Islamic schools that actively, what do? They isolate children. Of course, that's wrong. We don't agree with that approach, yes? But if there's anything you need to worry about, is about your child being overexposed to the wrong values, not raising him in a bubble. All it takes for him is to download a couple apps. He'll know everything about everything. He'll know too much. Parents say, I want to make sure he's not raised in a bubble. You know, one parent told me, I want to make sure that when he leaves school, he can hold a conversation with other people. Trust me, if he's confident in his skin, he can hold conversations better than anybody else. Because he's confident in who he is. He knows his values. He's grounded. I'm afraid I'm going to raise my child in an isolated way. Those days are over. Even if you wanted to raise your child in an isolated fashion, you can't. You think you can raise a child that's isolated with Instagram and this social media app and that social media? It's not even possible anymore. You're worried about the wrong thing. Yes, very, very limited instances you'll find people, this is an issue. But that's not the number one issue I need to be worried about. Not in today's world. This is usually from parents who aren't familiar with the world, how it is set up today. This is objection number two. Let us move on. Objection number three. Sheikh, I don't want to use this option. Why? You know why, Sheikh? Because, you know, my child is going to be exposed to the evil values and the wrong values in society anyways. So let him be exposed now. He's going to find out all this stuff later anyways. So let him be exposed now. Sheikh, isn't he going to go to college? Yes. So when he goes to college, I'm not going to be there to watch him. So now he's 10. Let him just engage. If I came to the same parents and I said, brother, this biryani that you made, I want to show your child what happened to the animal. Can I show him that content? Can I show him the footage of what happened to the chicken or the goat or the cow or whatever it is? He'll say, no, my child is 7. My child is 8. This is gruesome content. This is violent content. No, it's against guidelines. Can I just sit there and say, Baba, he's going to be exposed later anyways. One of the most traumatic experiences I had when I moved to Iran, we had Qurbani. Saw the full thing. He's going to be exposed anyway, so he might as well get to know these things now. No, there's a major difference when your child is exposed to things. Many of the social issues that we have within society is because someone was exposed to something at a young age. Instead of being able to deal with it and maneuver it, it turns into an addiction. Look at the studies that are done on explicit content, brothers and sisters. When a person is exposed to that content is the number one factor about whether it turns into an addiction or not. There's a big difference if my child is 10 and he comes across this versus when my child is 18 and he has a full understanding of things. Let my child have a strong foundation. Don't worry when he has the right foundation. Later on, as society throws challenges at him, he will maneuver those challenges. How come you were able to maneuver those challenges? Because you had a strong foundation. He will be able to maneuver those challenges as well. This is objection number 3. Let us move on. Objection number 4. Sheikh, I don't think this is a good idea. You know why? Because my brother's cousin went to Islamic school, but he didn't turn out well. The son of brother Fulan grew up in an Islamic environment, but we know what he does. He didn't turn out well. Okay, so we said if you put your child in a good environment, definitely he's going to be raised perfect and all this. No, it's about likelihood. So if I come to you and I say, oh, listen, I know someone, they had their seatbelt on and then they got into a car accident and they still got hurt. You're not going to wear a seatbelt anymore? No, you say, I need that seatbelt because the likelihood of things drop heavily. It's all about likelihood. Yes, the son of Nuh also went the wrong way. Are you going to say Nuh didn't know how to parent? The wife of Lut happened this. The wife of Nuh. Some of the brothers of imams, children of imams, went down the wrong road. It's all about giving your family the best possible chance. Of course, you can't guarantee anything. And that's why you have to constantly pray for them. And that's why you have to, at the end of the day, do your work and then say, oh Allah, you take the rest and you do the rest, because there's nothing guaranteed. One of the most painful things I come across as someone who works in this profession is what? A parent who is very strong on his Islamic values, but for whatever reason, sometimes it's his own fault, sometimes not. The child is not in this path. Oh, the pain in his eyes. And he comes to me and says, Sheikh, I'm very much connected to my faith, but my son or my daughter, no. Difficult, it's difficult. Sheikh, this Muharram, pray for them. This Ramadan, pray for them. It's very difficult. And I don't want to see community members in that position, brothers and sisters. You know why? Because that only shows that end of it, in that side of it, when it's too late. Now's the time. Now's the time when this child of mine, his world is still being built around me. I know this person, he didn't turn out well. Sure, there's many people who go in a good environment and don't turn out well. But the question is, did they have a better shot over there? Absolutely. They had a better opportunity over there. Objection number 5. Sheikh, I didn't go and grow up in an Islamic environment, but I turned out well. First of all, this is pretty arrogant of you. Look at me, I'm perfect. But setting that aside, it's a real objection. I remember I was having this conversation with a 30-year-old. He said, Sheikh, all of this Islamic environment, youth events, all of this kind of stuff, schooling. Sheikh, I mean, many of my classmates and I, we didn't go to Islamic school. But we turned out fine. So I looked at him and I said, huh, these peers of yours that you're talking about, other Muslim children, how come you're the only one in this masjid having this conversation with me? Where are they? How come I haven't seen them in 10 years? Because they're not connected to their faith. Doesn't mean they're bad. Doesn't mean they're bad people. Well, many of them have good intentions, good people. But are they connected to their faith? Are they loyal to that faith? Or do they tolerate their faith? Tolerating your faith is one thing. Being connected to your faith is another thing, brothers and sisters. And the direction that society is moving in, things will only become worse. And if our communities turn a blind eye to this and don't make schooling a priority, unfortunately, they will pay the price. And we have already begun paying the price. I have mentioned this before, I'll mention it again, brothers and sisters. When Muharram and Safar comes around and these masajid of ours get filled up, alhamdulillah, this doesn't show that we're doing an amazing job. This is a part of the puzzle. It's a piece of the puzzle. Yes, people come for the love of the Ahlul Bayt, of course. But why is it the rest of the year you don't feel this? Why is it the rest of the year so many of our younger generation, they don't feel connected to their faith? This is the love of Hussein. This is the love of Abbas. Of course they'll come. There's no doubt about that. But the 10 nights of Muharram and Safar and 10 nights of Muharram Ashra are not your indicating factor. At least not the only one. I'll put it that way. Therefore, if I find myself in a situation where the community that I'm living in cannot provide for me this option, brothers and sisters, so we can't, for whatever reason, this is not a priority. Is this a reason for me to actually pack up potentially and look for a community where this is an option? Yes, this is one of the factors where you can take it and consider packing up and moving to a different community, potentially. Moving is a difficult thing to do. It's not easy. You have to uproot yourself from a place where you have built roots, maybe sometimes for multiple generations. So I say this very carefully, huh? But this is one of the factors, because your duty first and foremost is to your family. This is one of the factors where I say, you know what? Potentially, if this is not an option for us, where else can I go to give my children the best possible opportunity for them to be able to raise their family? I always tell young couples, as long as you're a young couple, and it's just you guys, you can go even live technically on the North Pole. You'll have your YouTube majalis and you'll listen to this. And when you have a question, you'll know how to reach out to ask that question and so on and so forth. The moment that child shows up, things have changed fundamentally. Nothing is the same again. Now when that child shows up, now you have to start thinking hard and long about what type of environment I want to bring him up in. And inshallah, if you do a good job, then hopefully Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will bless your efforts. He will take care of your shortcomings. And inshallah, you have a child that makes you proud. Sometimes a parent might have to invest 20 years of their life into their child, just so that after 20 years, this child, who by the way, might seem like he's not picking up on any of these Islamic values initially, after 20 years, the parent observes that his child is working in this career, but he stops everything when it's time for salat. That moment for a parent is worth the 20 years of investing in him. It's worth it. And you know what will burn the heart of any parent is if after 20 years and all of this effort, because I didn't do my part, now he is in this career or that career, and now his family life is falling apart, and now this divorce is taking place, and now, for example, he's taking on his career, but the wrong career altogether, and now on the nights of Friday, instead of coming to places to get together with his family and others, he's going other places. And this is the realities that we have, brothers and sisters. We can't be naive to assume that these things aren't happening with our younger generation. They are definitely happening with our younger generation. And they are not to blame. You and I are to blame, because we have to do our part in this regard. Hence, when you find someone is raised in the proper environment with the proper values, then you see he shines. And who was it who shined like this? But Abul Fadl al-Abbas, the one who is raised in the school of Amirul Mu'mineen, and the one who is raised in the school of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, and the one who is raised in the school of Imam al-Hussein and Lady Zainab. Of course, when you are raised in these schools, then you shine as brightly as you did, yes? And this is why the musibah and the masa'ib of losing Abul Fadl al-Abbas was so difficult for Abu Abdullah. On the 10th of Muharram. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka ya Ibn Rasulullah. Let us take our hearts, brothers and sisters, to the 10th of Muharram and the plains of Karbala. Because tonight's musibah is different maybe from all of the other masa'ib that we will recite during these 10 nights. And that is the musibah of Hussein losing his final backbone, of Hussein losing the one he used to rely on, of Hussein losing the one he used to look back. Anytime there was karb on the face of Hussein, anytime there was difficulty in the life of Hussein, who would Hussein turn to? One of those that Hussein would turn to was Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. The poet says, I began to write poetry for Imam al-Hussein. And what happened on the 10th of Muharram? I was praising the different characters. I came to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. I said, you were the one who, when the infallible Imam would run into difficulty and pain, he would come looking at you. He said, I took my pen and I put it down for a second. And I thought to myself, you know what? Maybe I went too far. Maybe I have misspoken. Maybe I shouldn't say that Hussein relied on Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas like this. He says, I went home that night and I took my sleep that night. He says, in my dream, I saw Imam al-Hussein came to me. Yes? And when Imam al-Hussein came to me, he said, listen, Fulan, your poetry was right. On that day, the infallible Imam was looking for support from who? From Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. That is how difficult the pain of the 10th of Muharram was. And that is how much Hussein was in need of the support of his brother. But what has happened to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas on the 10th of Muharram? He has seen so many bodies go to the battlefield and come back in pieces. Yes? He has stood there and watched. Ali ibn al-Akbar came to the tent of Hussein, asked for permission. He went to the battlefield and they had to come back and bring back his body. Qasim ibn al-Hassan went to the battlefield. They had to bring back his body. Every time there's a wound on the heart of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, every time as the commander of Hussein, he has to witness these moments that keep happening. It was too much for him. But you know what pain it was maybe that broke the heart of Abbas more than anything else? You know what it was that made it unbelievably difficult for Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas? I think it was the al-Atash that he kept hearing from these women and the children. This was the one that killed Abbas, because he had the might, he had the strength, but there's an ocean of an army in front of him. From the morning he's been hearing al-Atash, al-Atash, we're thirsty. And what can Abbas do standing there with all of these women and children? The narration says some of them were looking for these cool parts of the sand to pull up their clothes and put their bodies on that part of the sand just so that they could cool down a little bit more. And maybe Abbas keeps hearing the cry of Ali ibn al-Asghar in these moments, yes? And maybe he keeps hearing the cry of the mother of Ali ibn al-Asghar. This is why at one point Abu al-Fadl Abbas, he made his way to the tent of Hussein and he only asked this one sentence, this one question. He said, Ya Akhi, my brother, Halli min rukhsatin, will you give me permission? The moment Hussein heard these words, Hussein started to fall apart. The Maqatil have narrated one line. This one line is enough for you. He said, Fabbaka al-Husseinu buka'an shadida. Hussein cried this time, but he cried a heavy crying. This one was the most severe for Hussein. This was the one that Hussein couldn't take it anymore. فَبَكَى الْحُسَيْنُ بُكَاءً شَدِيدًا. Hussein started to cry heavily. Imagine your mullah standing there, the strongest of all standing there, the most patient of all there, and Hussein and Abbas says one line to him, and Hussein starts to fall apart in front of him. فَبَكَى الْحُسَيْنُ بُكَاءً and Shadida, the tears are coming down the face of Abu Abdullah. He can't take this moment at all. He turned to Abbas. He said, Ya Akhi, Anta Sahibu Liwa'i, you're the flag bearer of this army. You're the one who's the backbone of this army. Wa idha madaita, you know if you leave, Tafarraqa Askari, you know if you leave Abbas, there will be nothing left from my army. You know this and you still come and make this request, yes? You still come and put my heart through pain like this, yes? And then Abbas turned to him. He said, Oh Hussein, you know what the problem is? فَقَدْ سَئِمْتُ مِنَ الْحَيَاتِ. I'm tired of this life because my heart can't take the pain anymore. Every time I stand here and they bring back the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar and they bring back the body of Qasim and they bring back the body of Aun and Muhammad, I can't take it anymore. So Hussein turned towards him and said, Abbas,
us, at least if you're going to leave. Go, فَاطْلُبْ لِهَؤُلَاءِ الْأَطْفَالِ قَلِيلًا مِنَ الْمَاءِ. Go and bring a little bit of water for these children. The narration says Abu al-Fadl Abbas went on the horse. He made his way out. He began speaking to this ocean of an army that's in front of him, but they didn't listen. Hussein Abu al-Fadl Abbas went back to grab his mashk. Imagine the women and children at the entrance of the tents. Maybe some of these children have a little bit of hope, yes? Because they say, this time our uncle Abbas is going. This time the flag bearer is going. Never has Abbas come back without a victory. Never has Abbas come back with making their hope into a lack of hope. The narration says Abbas got on his horse. He started to strike through this army to make his way towards Furat. He finally got to Furat. He gets off of his horse and fills this mashk. He fills the water with this mashk, and the narration says he got back on his horse. But we tell Abbas, oh Abbas, if you only knew what is waiting for you in these moments. If you only knew what these enemies of Allah have prepared for you. The narration says he started to make his way back, and all of a sudden Abbas saw the arrows from every direction. It doesn't matter where you ride. When there's arrows coming from the sky in every direction, it's going to catch you left and right. The narration says he rode as his body continued to catch all of these arrows, but they didn't stop there. All of a sudden, someone came out of nowhere and struck his right arm. But Abu al-Fadl Abbas continues on this path, yes? Because his eye is only on this mashk. His eye is only on this water. The narration says he continued, they struck him on his left arm, and he still has this mashk. But you know that point came where the arrows were too many. All of a sudden, فَجَاءَهُ سَهْمٌ, one of these arrows came, فَأَصَابَ الْقِرْبَ, it hit the water skin, and the water started to drip away in front of Abu al-Fadl Abbas. And I tell you, with that water in the water skin, the tears of Abu al-Fadl Abbas started to flow from his eyes. The maqatil have this one terminology. They said, فَتَحَيَّرَ الْعَبَّاسِ. Abbas didn't know in these moments, do I go back to get water again? Or do I go back to the tents to see the women and the children? And in this tahayyur, Abu al-Fadl Abbas was struck on the head and he fell on the ground and he called out, Ya Akha, Adrik Akha, my brother, come to the aid and assistance of Abbas. They say Hussein ran in those moments and sat beside the body of Abu al-Fadl Abbas. What did they say in those moments together? We don't know the whole conversation, but I'm sure at some point Abu al-Fadl Abbas turned to Hussein and said, listen, when you go back to the tents, tell these women and children what happened to me. I know your children had the hope that I would bring water for them. I know the mother of Ali and Al-Asghar is waiting for me. I know everyone is thirsty in the tents. Tell them what I did for them. And maybe at that point, Abu al-Fadl Abbas turned to Hussein and said, don't worry, I will offer your salams to my mother, Fatima. Because in those moments, you can be sure that Fatima was also mourning Abu al-Fadl Abbas. But the narration says, what did Hussein see when he came to his body? This body was murammalun bid-dima. It was full of blood. He could barely find a point on this body that didn't have arrows on it, that didn't have wounds on it, until Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas take his final breaths. And then Hussein has to come back to his tents. And all the narrations say, he came back while he was holding his back, huh? He came back because he said, now my back is broken. Al-an inkasara dhahri. Now my back is broken. Wa qallat hilati. I can't take it anymore. This one was too much for Hussein. All he did was he came back to the tents. All these women and children are asking, what happened to our uncle Abbas? He said, there's no more Abbas. Yes, maybe some of the children came back and said, father, we don't want water anymore. Just tell him to come back at least. Let us see our uncle one more time. But all Hussein did was come to the tent and pull the column of the tents. Yes, and he told them, now know, the time of captivity has begun. The time of Asara has begun. Zainab, go and prepare these women and children, because now Abbas is gone. There is no one to defend them anymore. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون.
Let us console the hearts of our beloved Imam and send our salam to the plains of Karbala.
As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifina'ik. عليك مني جميعا سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم.
Everyone.
السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب.
One more time.
As-salamu ala al-Husayn wa ala Ali ibn al-Husayn wa ala awlad al-Husayn wa ala ashab al-Husayn jami'an wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salawat.